We turn again to the book of Exodus and reading in chapter 2 this evening. Last Wednesday we had an introductory study of the opening chapter and part of chapter 2. And I think it would be true to say that the general emphasis in the opening section of the book is that of the sovereignty of God at work on behalf of his people, even when he hides himself so wondrously, as the hymn puts it, as though there were no God. And the point of this marvelous domestic idyll in chapter 2, which we looked at for some time last Wednesday, is simply that in the very human circumstances of this humble family, we see the mighty hand of God at work in preparing and providing a deliverer for his people. The raising up of Moses, even while Israel was crying out in their distress and despair. And it's perhaps helpful for us to look at the end of chapter 2 to see how this whole divine operation is bounded. In verse 23, it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. But they didn't realize it at the time, and they were in despair. And it's in the context of that hopelessness and despair that we see this wonderful story, the emerging purposes of God in the provision of a deliverer. F.B. Meyer, in his fine two-volume work on the book of Exodus, speaks of the conflict between hope and despair, between the heroism of the mother who hid her baby boy and the pessimism of the nation which sighed unto heartbreak at the end of chapter 2. Now, with that by way of summing up last week's message, let's look at chapter 2. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. It's later in the book that we learn that their names are Amram and Jochebed. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister, Miriam, stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him, and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Whether she could recognize that the child was a Hebrew by the look of it, or she put two and two together and realized with a flash of insight what had happened, we don't know. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto the mother, Take this child away, and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, Because I drew him out of the water. And it came to pass in those days, that really finishes the domestic idyll and the birth of Moses. Verse 11, It came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian, and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said to him that did the wrong, Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me, as thou killedst the Egyptian? And Moses feared, and said, Surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh, and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove the daughters away. But Moses stood up and helped them, and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, How is it that you are come so soon today? And they said, An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us, and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, And where is he? Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses Zipporah his daughter, and she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. And it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. So on to the end of the chapter. Now, before we make any comment, I want you to look up to the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 3. We referred to Stephen's great utterance in the before the Sanhedrin in the Acts of the Apostles, and I want us to look at how Stephen interpreted the story of Moses, because we'll be making reference to that. Acts chapter 7, and we'll break in at verse 15. So Jacob went down into Egypt and died, he and our fathers, and were carried over to Sychem, and laid in the sepulchre that Abraham bought for a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Sychem. But when the time of the promise drew nigh, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose, which knew not Joseph. That's a quotation from chapter 1, of course, in Exodus. The same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children to the end they might not live. In which time Moses was born, and was exceeding fair, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up, and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. Now, we've no note of that in the book of Exodus, and that's an interesting comment. Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him, and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set at them one again, saying, Sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbour wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? Then Moses fled at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons. And when 40 years were expired, that means he was 80 years old when this happened, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. When Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight. And as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses trembled and durst not behold. Then saith the Lord to him, Put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. I have seen the affliction of my people which is in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning, and am come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send thee into Egypt. This Moses, whom they refused, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge? The same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel which appeared to them in the bush. He brought them out after he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt, and in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, A prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. And so on. Now, that's Stephen's comment on the story that is before us tonight. Well now, what are we going to say about all these things? I think what we need to recognize at the outset, and this is corroborated by Stephen's comments, is that Moses, God's appointed deliverer, was put under training. And we needn't doubt but that his experience in Egypt was an integral part of that training. As Stephen puts it, he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. F.B. Meyer says some interesting things about this. He was sent to the great city and university of Heliopolis by the banks of the Nile to be instructed in all the learning of that time. It was with considerable emotion, F.B. Meyer says, that on one memorable afternoon I stood on the ruins of that ancient city and tried to imagine Moses as a young student, one of 10,000 drawn from the whole known world. Of the result of this training, Stephen says, Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in his words and deeds. Now notice that phrase that Stephen uses. He was mighty in his words and deeds. It's very interesting. You may recall the story that when God appeared to Moses from the burning bush and said he was going to send him to Egypt and to Pharaoh, what Moses pleaded was, Lord, I cannot speak. I'm not your man. And yet he was learned in all the wisdom of Egypt and was mighty in his words. That is to say, he had been taught in the arts of oratory and rhetoric, which was the staple educational format for the whole of the ancient world, and that persisted into the time of the early church fathers and even further on than that. As to his works, the historian Josephus tells us that Moses became an illustrious soldier and led the Egyptian troops against the Ethiopian city of Meroe, which he took. That's interesting. Now that's the Jewish historian, and that's the kind of background information that can often light up a situation. He was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And we need to fill that kind of simple statement in and imagine just exactly what he had been subjected to in his 40 years in Egypt. But notice, long before he got to that stage of learning in Egypt, there was his experience in the Ark of Bulrushes. Now, it will help us, I think, to consider the human feelings and anguish of Moses' mother and father when this little helpless child was consigned to the Ark of Bulrushes and put by the river bank. In the beauty of the story, we might tend to forget that there must have been a terribly anguished side. Here was a Hebrew mother. She knew that all male children were being slaughtered by Pharaoh as a matter of policy. She didn't know what was going to happen to her precious child. This was her way of giving it some protection. But with what anguish and heartbreak she must have put that child into the Ark of Bulrushes and left it by the river bank, not knowing what was going to happen. If the baby was discovered, would it be immediately slaughtered? Think of that. Now, it's in that context, you see, that you see that the miracle that took place was a miracle of death and resurrection. Moses' parents received their child back from the dead. And in this miraculous way, this child that was put away, abandoned, as it were, almost to death, was given back to them. And for these three precious years, they had the care of their own little child before he was put into Pharaoh's daughter's palace. So that he was set apart unto God right from the beginning. And there's a very real sense in which his whole existence was an existence in the grace of God. He passed through death and was brought back to life again. You die to live, you see, in Christian service. And we are to yield ourselves to God, as we were reading on Sunday evening in Romans 6, as those that are alive from the dead. And this, in fact, is what happened to Moses. And when the time came when he grew up, that symbolic ark experience was wrought out in very real terms. For there came a time, if I may anticipate, and to quote Hebrews chapter 11, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to become the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He made a choice. And he turned his back. Now, do you see what's happening there? This is the fulfillment in practical, real terms of the symbol that was enacted for him when he was a baby. In much the same way as when babies are baptized. They're baptized unto faith. And in the fullness of the time, the symbol is wrought out in reality, in an experience of conversion and consecration and service for God, whereby a man, when he comes to years, turns his back upon the old ways and is born into a new situation. Now, that's what happened with Moses in the Ark experience. He was nurtured in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and I do not think we should belittle that, secular and heathen though the education was. We don't have to knock an educational system simply because it was a heathen system. There was much in ancient learning that was very wonderful and very advanced. And Moses had all the advantages of a university education in the highest halls of learning in Egypt. But he had other things to learn. And therefore, God had to put him to another school. And the next 40 years of his life were spent in the wilderness. Stephen tells us that it was when he was 40 years old that this happened. Verse 11. Moses was grown, he went out unto his brethren, and looked on their burdens, and spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew. Now, some of the commentators tend to lay quite an emphasis on the phrase in verse 11, he went out unto his brethren, and suggest that this was not a mere casual encounter, and that in all probability what the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews says of Moses when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, was taking place at that particular time. And that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and it was in that context that an awareness came to him that he was God's appointed deliverer. And indeed, Stephen seems to suggest that very strongly, because he knew that he was appointed, according to Stephen, as the Lord's deliverer. And he thought that the Hebrews that he spoke to on the second day should have understood that, but they didn't. But he was aware of it. So it does seem likely that if we want to find a place in the Exodus story where the wonderful words in Hebrews, and let's just look at them in Hebrews chapter 11 to refresh our minds as to what is said about Moses. Verse 23 of Hebrews 11. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Now, it does seem, on reflection, that that experience of refusing took place at this time, and therefore it invests the phrase he went out unto his brethren with a peculiar and a particular significance. But this is the whole point. To make this great refusal was clearly an act of consecration in which he fully and utterly committed himself to God for his purposes. That is to say, we must assume that he was willing for all God's perfect will for his life. And that's very wonderful, you say, and you are right. It is very wonderful. But to be willing is not the same as to be ready. And the point of this episode being recorded in verses 11 to verse 14 is to show to us that his willingness was matched with a state of unreadiness that led him into a very great deal of trouble and obliged him to flee the country. And for 40 years, God kept him in the wilderness. Now, this is an important point, and I would go so far as to say that this is probably the heart and essence of the message of this passage for us tonight. Because what Moses did here, and we need not doubt that he did it with the best of intentions, he saw a Hebrew being maltreated by an Egyptian guard, and he intervened and slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. It was in a sense the matter of a moment. He saw red, as we would say. But you see, he must have been conscious at this point in time that God had appointed him as a deliverer. He must have known this. And this was the context in which he consecrated himself to God. And yet, this is what he did. And this clearly, it seems to me, manifests that he fell victim to using the arm of the flesh, not recognizing that the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but spiritual and mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. And consecration to God didn't thereby fit him for serving God. Because on any estimate, this was a critical error for him to have committed. Now, this opens up a very major issue. And it's something that often isn't considered nearly as carefully as it ought to be or it might be. It's just not true that consecration to Christ qualifies you to serve him. Because consecration is the starting point of true Christian living. As Paul makes very clear in Romans, and we'll be seeing this again and again in our ongoing studies on Sunday evenings. Consecration is not the goal of Christian life. It's the starting point. You begin there, and then you enter training. Now, there are lots of good Christian folk who do not appear to understand that consecration doesn't qualify you simpliciter to serve the Lord. And it's when people don't realize that they make mistakes, as Moses did here. It's a grave mistake, for example, to suppose that anything will do, provided something is done in the service of the Lord. That way, all sorts of unfortunate things can happen, and sometimes indeed tragic things. Let me give you one or two instances. Do you remember the story in Mark's Gospel, at the end of chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel? Listen to these words. Verse 40. There came a leper to Jesus, beseeching him and kneeling down to him, saying, "If thou wilt, thou canst make me clean." And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him and said unto him, "I will, be thou clean." And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy departed from him, and he was cleansed. And he straightly charged him, and forthwith sent him away, and said unto him, "See thou say nothing to any man, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer for thy cleansing those things which Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. See thou say nothing to any man." But he went out and began to publish it much, and to blaze abroad the matter, insomuch that Jesus could no more openly enter into the city, but was without in desert places. Now do you see what happened with that man? In the flush and thrill and excitement and glory of being cleansed of his leprosy and his becoming a disciple of Christ, the first thing he did was to disobey Jesus, a clear command. Jesus said, "See thou say nothing to any man." And the man went out and blazed it abroad. And look what happened. It seriously interfered with Jesus' plans and purposes for his ministry. Jesus could no more openly enter into the city. That's what the man did. Now, don't you think that's an extraordinary thing? You might even say, "Oh, but it's the natural thing to tell." But it can't be the natural thing to tell. If Jesus said, "Don't say a thing, don't say a word to anybody." See, it's a matter of obedience to Jesus. We mustn't be too hard on the leper. He'd been cleansed, and a great thing had happened to him. And nobody could doubt his love for the man who had cleansed him, or his devotion, or his dedication to him, his discipleship. But his disobedience all but wrecked the Lord's program. Now you see, his consecration was not in doubt. But he wasn't ready for service. Things had to be done in that man. And that's what this chapter is all about. And I think that this has very, very wide application. The book of Ecclesiastes says, there is a time to speak, and there is a time to keep silent. And as disciples, we have to learn the difference, and know when to speak, and when not to speak. It's as simple as that. And lots of people apparently find it very difficult to learn, because you see, they're working to a preconceived pattern. They think it's always the time to speak. Therefore they speak, and forget that there are times not to speak. And you know, when you speak when you shouldn't speak, you're going to do a lot of harm to the work of God. This is how it was with Moses. I have often been very concerned, for example, and to pitch this on a much more up-to-date and relevant note, I've often been very concerned about unwise speaking at the General Assembly, for example, by young ministers in debate. And there are some men, we could never doubt their sincerity or their earnestness, but they get up and speak in the assembly and put their foot right into it and do a great deal of harm. And one is prompted to think, if only they had consulted an older minister and asked, do you think it would be wise for me to intervene in this particular debate? But you see, they seem to imagine that they know it all. And up they get. And I may tell you that it's been a huge embarrassment to some of us older evangelical men in the church when some of these young men have just got up and spouted and said things that they should never have said and have done harm to the testimony and to the work. You see my point? Let me be more specific. You may, I'm sure you are aware, that at the present time there is a crisis in the church with regard to the ordination of women elders. Now, this was an issue that was thrashed out in 1967, 68, was it? And the church passed a law that women could be and were eligible for ordination to the eldership on the same terms as men. That was the law, and as it was promulgated, it meant that if a Kirk Session wished to ordain women to the eldership, they could do so, and women could be ordained. In other words, it was an act permitting the ordination of women. But what is happening now is that the permissive legislation has gradually come to be prescriptive legislation. And there have been statements made by officials of the church to the effect that if a Kirk Session, if a minister refuses to ordain women as elders, he is guilty of contumacy and unfaithfulness to his vows, and therefore is subject to discipline by the church. And if he continued to refuse to do this, he could be suspended or dismissed the ministry. Now, you can see that there's a crisis there. That's the background as to what I'm want to say now. The question that arises is, what is the wise thing for evangelical men to do? Well, I'll tell you this, that there were some evangelical men at the assembly who seemed determined to bring this up at the assembly and to challenge the assembly on the matter. Uh, And one or two wiser men at the assembly this year spent a good deal of time urging them to be quiet and not bring it up. For if it had been brought up, all that would have happened would have been for the situation to have crystallized and hardened, and a situation would then have arisen very like what has already happened in the Canadian Presbyterian Church, when unless a theological student affirms that he will ordain women as elders, he will not be licensed at all. Now, mercifully, that stage has not been reached in the Church of Scotland. But if somebody had brought it up last week, there is no doubt in my mind that that is what would happen. Now, you see what I mean by there being a time to be silent and a time to speak. It is very possible by an unwise and ill-considered action and challenge to queer the pitch and do a great deal of despite to the evangelical cause in Scotland. Now, I have spoken to numbers of younger ministers for whom this is a very, very real and burning issue. And I have advised them to play it as low-key as possible and not to take the initiative. Not to raise the issue either in presbytery or in assembly for that very reason. And it seems to me that when you get somebody who thinks he knows everything, who knows it all, getting up on his feet, one just trembles at what could happen to the evangelical testimony in the church. And I would have thought that it would be very advisable for a young man like that, first of all, to consult with some of us older men and ask, do you think it would be a good idea to do such and such, or do you think not? And be prepared to be guided by perhaps wiser counsel. See what I mean? To be consecrated is not the same thing as to be ready. And there may be a fairly good case made out for saying that Moses' ill-timed action here was one contributory factor delaying God's ultimate deliverance. And it's clear that it was not until that particular Pharaoh had died off before it was even safe for Moses to move from the wilderness of Midian. And that raises a very disturbing possibility. By our ill-timed interventions, we can sometimes put the clock back for years in the work of God. Now, this is not meant to inculcate a fear of doing anything in case you do something wrong, but rather it is a warning against the apparently easy assumption that many Christians make, that they know everything and they know what is to be done. In a congregational situation, the same can happen. I remember when I came to Holyrood 30 years ago, I found a great many things in the life of the congregation that I was acutely unhappy about. But I also knew that the thing not to do was to wield the big stick and clear a lot of the things out. And I conceived it as my task when I came to Holyrood to be simply to present the gospel in as true and as attractive a way as I could. And I preached the positive riches of God's grace in Christ for the first 7 months, morning and evening. I did not make a single mention of any of the things that would grieve my spirit, things that were taking place in the organizational life of the congregation, and so on. I just said nothing in criticism of them. My task, I felt, was to preach the gospel. And you know, by the summertime of that year, I came here in January 58, and by the summertime, there wasn't a soul in the congregation but knew instinctively what my attitude to these things were. I didn't have to say a word. I think the preaching was such that comparing the preaching with things that were going on, the two things obviously didn't mix. And people were getting the message. I didn't have to. But I went on holiday that summer and I got some students to preach for me. And one student took it upon himself to wield the big stick in no uncertain manner. And he lambasted particularly the Women's Guild for the secular items in their annual program. They were in fact almost all secular items, but he really walloped them. And all that happened was a great deal of resentment developed in many hearts against the gospel, against me. I hadn't said these things, but they were said by somebody who knew better than I did how to run a congregation, as if to say, I'll show them. You see what I mean? That was Moses here. That's what he did. He took a swipe at this Egyptian. And he must have been very disconcerted the next day when the Hebrew turned on him and said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed that Egyptian yesterday?" That shook him. Surely this thing is known. And when Pharaoh heard it, he sought to slay Moses. And Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. If there had been somebody he could have consulted, they might have said to him, "Moses, that's just not on. That's not the way to do it. That's not the way. Don't strike that Egyptian. That's not the way God wants you to do his work. God will not honor that." Maybe he felt impatient at any advice or counsel that he might have been given, I don't know. But what I do know is that lots of people are impatient of that kind of counsel because they think they know better. But they don't know better. And that's why some of the young men in the ministry have such a very difficult time. They've made it more difficult for them than it need have been, because they've gone in with the big stick right at the outset. That's not the way. A congregation is a human group of people. They may never have known any better. They may never have heard the true message of grace. What's the use of sweeping away things that have meant a lot to them before you've ever given them something better to displace them? Displacement, not sweeping away. Now, that's just an example of the kind of thing I mean. To be consecrated is not the same as being ready. And so Moses had to be put to school. And I would like to think that Moses cottoned on to this. It's very interesting that he was confronted in the land of Midian by a similar case of injustice. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the trough, and the shepherds came and drove them away. It was unjust, it was unfair. But Moses stood up and helped them. But it doesn't say that he had recourse to violence this time. It seemed that he quietly but firmly was able to help the daughters of Reuel. And maybe already he's learned his lesson to some extent. And that's a hopeful sign, isn't it? And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that ye are come home so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and drew water." It seems that this was a common practice, a common injustice. But they didn't go out with banners and slogans. Not in those days. Which is maybe an advantage. He said unto his daughters, "Where is he? Why is it that he have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And then this, "And Moses was content to dwell with the man." Content. Now, what does that say to you? What does that say to us? He was content. He had just left Egypt and the palace. And the life of learning and culture that he'd been brought up in. This must have been tremendous contrast, living in tents in Midian. But he was content. Because, you see, he discerned that God's hand was on him. And he was beginning to get the message. God had said to him, "Moses, you are my man." "But Moses, I have to knock you into shape, because that kind of carry-on is not going to do. That's not the way to do my work. And you'll not do that again." And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And in fact, he was there for 40 years. These verses encapsulate that very substantial period of time, as Stephen's apology makes clear. For 40 years, he dwelt with Midian, Reuel. And he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter, to wife. And she bare him a son, and called his name Gershom. For he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. There's a great pathos about that, isn't there? I think that speaks volumes about what it must have meant to Moses to be isolated in that way. And he named his son as a reminder, as it were, of what these days had meant for him in terms of loneliness and deprivation and isolation. Don't let us underestimate the cost of isolation in the service of God. Think of that dear young couple out in Botswana, Keith and Joe Irvin, in total isolation amongst the Bushmen, who speak a language which is more difficult than any language on earth to learn. That kind of isolation. Do you suppose it's easy to be a missionary in that kind of situation? Ah, let's remember something of the cost that drops off on such people. This is how it was with Moses. But it's perhaps reading a little more into this than we should, but I question whether it is reading more into it than we should. Verse 21, Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. Is there not a parable there? It was when Moses was content to be in God's will that God added the human partnership. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto me. Moses was content to dwell with the man. And it was when he got there, that place of contentment with the divine will and the divine training, that God added the human relationships. I remember once walking around the quadrangle at King's College. This was quite a number of years after I was in the ministry, and I must have been down speaking at one of the student meetings. I was walking round the quad with a young lad of, he was maybe 18 or 19, who had lots of girl problems. And in the course of our conversation, I was trying to counsel him. I said, you know, Stephen, God didn't give me a wife until I was, how old was I? 38. I was going to say 35. I said to him, God didn't give me a wife until I was 38. Maybe you'll have to wait a while. And he nearly dropped down dead. And the horror with which he contemplated that awful thought was almost too much for him. But this was the point I was trying to make. If we are under training, what sort of a God would he be if he let us do anything we liked? I want this, I want this. And God comes to us and says, you silly man, behave yourself, and puts us into the fire until we squeal with the pain and the frustration. Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter, to wife, and she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land, and all the human pathos of what it must have meant for Moses comes out in that name that he gave his firstborn son. And in the meanwhile, all that had been happening unknown to the people of God. And they were crying out in their distress, sighing by reason of the bondage, and saying, why does God not do something to help us? The heavens are as brass. And all the time this was going on, and God was shaping his man. And Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him. This is in relation to what is said at the end of the chapter. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant, and God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them, and he appeared to this man Moses out of the bush and revealed himself. I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. And he said, draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people, which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them. Come now, therefore, I will send thee to Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. 40 years on, 80 years after the first cries for deliverance were uttered, and the baby was born, and now Moses is 80 years old, and God is ready. God is not in a hurry, you see. He takes time to shape his instruments. He hides them in his quiver until they're properly sharpened, so that when he takes them and fires them, things happen. And my word, things began to happen from this time onwards. And that will be our study, God willing, next time. Let's pray.